Seth with Sustainable Strategies DC, and I will be serving as today's moderator. Thanks for joining us for another of the series of the Meet the Funders webinars. And many of you on the call today perhaps get EPA Brownfields assessment dollars, get cleanup dollars, but beyond that, once you have tackled your brownfield issues, there are a number of resource opportunities from the federal government to support your community revitalization plans. And a few months back, we did an economic development-focused webinar where we had folks on from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, the Economic Development Administration, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture talking about those resources. Today, we're going to be focused on infrastructure, and we're defining this broadly. This is roads, this is bike paths, this is sewers, this is stormwater, and this is green infrastructure. And again, there are numerous federal agencies that have programs, grants, technical assistance, and loans that you can tap into to support your brownfield projects. Today, I'll introduce the folks in just a minute, but we're going to be joined by folks from the U.S. Department of Transportation, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, as well as we're going to be talking about the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and some of their resources that can support your shoreline work. So again, this is Andy Seth, and who we've got from across the country participating and presenting today. I've got Amy Storm and Patricia Overmeyer here in the room with me from the Brownfield office. Patricia's actually going to give the introductory remarks in just a minute. I've got Danielle Rinsler from the U.S. Department of Transportation, Sonia Brubaker from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, Matt Ward, and he'll be a surrogate talking about the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And we're going to do a case study as well. We're going to talk about what some of these programs are. We're going to just skim the surface on a lot of these programs, so we encourage you at the Q&A period, if you've got deeper questions, we can get into that there. But we're going to be talking to the City of Toledo as well on this webinar. And we've got Mark Gerdman, David Dysard, and Scott Sibley on to talk about their brownfields, but how they have leveraged their EPA brownfield dollars with a lot of the resources that we're going to be talking today about. So again, I'm going to bring on Patricia in just a minute to give introductory remarks, but let me just talk about the agenda. There are those three federal agencies, and we'll go through this in 15-minute blocks, talking to the Department of Transportation, the EPA, and the Army Corps. We're using a format where I'm going to ask a question that I believe, and we've got a lot of community folks on from across the country, we'll be asking each of the agencies three, four questions that really drive at the information that I think cities, counties, and localities across the country really should take away from this webinar. And most importantly, some next steps. You're going to hear a lot of information, a lot of great resources that you can tap into, but we'll also share with you how you can make that next step and make contact with these agencies and start the ball rolling so that you can tap into some of the programs that they're talking about. We're going to follow that with the Toledo case study, as I mentioned, and Q&A at the end. And again, just to reiterate something that Gene said, if at any time during the webinar you have questions, go ahead and type those in. You don't have to wait until the end of the webinar to type those questions. Go ahead and load up the queue so that when we do turn to the Q&A period, we're ready with some great questions. So with that, I'm going to introduce Patricia Overmeyer. Patricia Overmeyer, and I'm sitting with her here at the Brownfield office at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And Patricia wanted to welcome everyone and offer a few introductory remarks.
Good day, everyone, and thank you, Andy. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. As you know, this is the third in a series of webinars that we're doing that are built off of our Leveraging Brownfields Resources Guide, which is available on the Brownfields website. So if you hadn't had the chance to join us for any of our previous webinars or to see our Leveraging Guide, all of the previous webinars are recorded and available on the CLUIN website, which Gene talked to you about a couple minutes ago. And the Leveraging Guide for the Use of Brownfields Resources is available on the U.S. EPA Brownfields website, which is www.epa.gov/brownfields. Also, I just want to remind everyone that today all of our speakers are talking about resources. As our programs stand today, we anticipate that our programs are going forward, and we're going to talk about these resources as if they will go forward. We have no reason to believe that they won't. And so you should anticipate that these resources will be available, and if anything changes or there are updates, you can always find updates on all of our websites. Also, those who are speaking today, as well as myself, we're not going away at the end of this webinar, so always feel free to contact us in the future with questions. You can send us emails. We will respond. We're here to help you as the community figure out what resources are available to you and how you can use them for your Brownfields Revitalization Project. So please use this as an informational session. Remember, our resources are available if you have questions in the future. After this webinar, you can give your questions to us today and also in the future. So with that, I just want to welcome our speakers and look forward to an informative session. Thank you.
And we've got a slide here as well just about some resources that you can take advantage of after today's webinar. And as Patricia mentioned, the EPA has put together a number of guidebooks, websites, and other tools that can help you think about this, not just on infrastructure, but really broadly. And we'll get to these topics in some future webinars, but there are a lot of resource opportunities. And let me just mention as well, and these are some links that you can follow post-webinar. This is, again, another of this series, and we're going to be doing another one on February 28th, and we're going to be focused on sustainability-type resources. So we'll be talking about smart growth and renewable energy and green infrastructure and other environmental aspects that you can find funding for on your brownfield projects. So we're going to jump right into it. These are the funders that we're going to tackle today: the U.S. Department of Transportation, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And we're going to start with the DOT. Now let me introduce Danielle Rinsler. Danielle is the acting team leader in the Office of Outreach and Project Development in the U.S. Department of Transportation's new Build America Bureau. This is something that got stood up in July of this year, so this may be new information to a lot of folks. The Build America Bureau helps to identify grants, financing opportunities, and technical assistance for community transportation priorities. Ms. Rinsler received her Master of Regional Planning with concentrations in transportation planning and economic development from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and a Bachelor of Science from Cornell University. We're happy to have Danielle with us today. And again, the format that we're going to follow, I'm going to pose a question, and then Danielle's going to have an opportunity to answer that through a series of slides. So Danielle, we'll kick this off. What funding options, as communities are thinking about what's next on a brownfield and want to tap into the Department of Transportation, what funding opportunities might be available to them immediately?
Well, thanks, Andy, for the introduction. As you can imagine, starting with this slide that outlines some of the modal administrations within the U.S. Department of Transportation. So it's a rather large organization, so there are a variety of grant programs spread throughout the department. So while I'll touch on a few in the webinar, there's a lot of information on each administration's website. Some of those links are provided within the presentation for folks who are listening in on the webinar. I'll specifically focus in on a couple of programs within the Office of the Secretary of Transportation, including the TIGER program, which many of you may be familiar with, and also the new Fast Lane Grants program, which is operated out of the Office of the Secretary in the Build America Bureau. And then I'll touch a little bit on some of the other grant programs throughout the department that may provide resources for community revitalization projects. So there are a number of freight and surface transportation funding sources within the department that can be leveraged by project sponsors and a variety of project sponsors. They don't necessarily have to be transportation entities. The FAST Act established a discretionary competitive grant program of $4.5 billion over the next 5 years for nationally and regionally significant highway, rail, port, and intermodal freight and highway projects. So this is commonly referred to as the Fastlane Grant Program. There's quite a bit of information provided at the link that Andy is showing on the screen. But the first round of Fastlane grants were issued last year for about $800 million. The department awarded 18 grants throughout the country. They're through a regionally and geographically diverse group of sponsors. And the second round of funding, the round closes tomorrow, in fact, the notice of funding opportunity. And we're expecting quite a large number of applicants for those grants. The states, the eligible sponsors include states, metropolitan planning organizations, tribes, localities, port authorities, and federal land management agencies as well. The projects must be at least $100 million in size to be awarded a grant, and generally the grants fund up to 60% of project costs. So that's important that communities or project sponsors have a very clear plan of finance for the balance of the funding. There is also a special set-aside for rural projects of about 25% each year in each round. And projects under $100 million, there is a small set-aside for 10% of projects that are smaller than the $100 million threshold. There's also a program that I'll talk a bit about, TIGER, which is appropriated by Congress on a year-by-year basis. They have appropriated TIGER for the last several years since 2009, so there is every expectation that the TIGER program will continue into the new administration. Typically, TIGER has been funded at around $500 million a year. So I'll talk a little bit more about TIGER. I think this is a really great resource for brownfield redevelopment projects for how to reuse sites that in particular have transportation elements to them. So the TIGER program can fund, it's a competitive program, it can fund various surface transportation projects from road, rail, transit, and port facilities. There are a variety of selection criteria that are important. There's primary criteria that include safety, state of good repair, economic competitiveness, quality of life, and environmental sustainability are listed here. The secondary criteria are innovation and partnership. One of the key things for the department is that grants consider and factor in ladders, what we call ladders of opportunity, that projects connect people to employment centers, educational facilities, and other essential services in a community. Projects that connect people to jobs, that create and potentially create new job opportunities for a community. And the third ladder of opportunity is projects that revitalize communities. They're really focused on neighborhood and regional revitalization. So you'll see it's a little hard to see, but and this is also found on the TIGER website, but the distribution of projects across modes. It's been a very successful program for communities around the country, and you can find more information on successful applicants as well at the DOT TIGER website that is found on the next on this slide. There's a lot of technical assistance offered from the department for TIGER applicants. So as folks are going through the application process, feel free to reach out to the department at, there's a TIGER grants email on this slide, and there are a number of recorded webinars on the DOT website that you can access from past webinars, both for TIGER and also for the Fastlane Grants Program. The next several slides, I won't go into great detail, but they provide some background on transit grants and formula grant programs within the department. There are a vast number of transit grant programs that your communities, likely transit agencies, already tap into. The FTA offers capital investment grants, which can help fund light rail, heavy rail, commuter rail, and streetcar and bus rapid transit projects. You may have heard of the New Starts program, Small Starts, and Core Capacity grants, which are a particular, probably among the larger programs within FTA. There's also the formula-based grants, and these are distributed from the Department of Transportation to each state based on a predetermined formula. So states, and in some cases metropolitan planning organizations, in turn award these grants to individual projects. So it's important to work with your states and your MPOs, if you have an MPO in your community, as they are often coordinating grant awards through the department's resources. You may have heard of CMAQ, the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Program, which offers $2.3 billion nationwide each year. These grants really typically reduce congestion and improve air quality in a community. And then there's also the $1.1 billion formula program called the National Highway Freight Program. Again, these are just a few of the grants that are offered through the department. There is a wide range of programs, and I highly encourage you to look further at the various websites that are highlighted in the presentation for more information. I won't go into detail in the next couple of slides, which include some resources from the Federal Transit Administration, two offices that manage a number of our grant programs are shown on the next two slides. And then the last slide shows some of the FHWA apportioned programs under FAST, under the FAST Act, and quite a bit of money from FHWA. About 92% of FHWA funds are apportioned to the states and MPOs. So again, it would be really incumbent upon project sponsors to reach out locally. And then finally, sorry, it's taken a while for slides to advance, but and the last one is just the Federal Railroad Administration, which the vast majority of rail network development funds go to Amtrak and to high-speed intercity passenger rail program grants, which may not be as relevant to this group, but thought still worth mentioning that it's very important that grant programs are changing all the time. In a lot of ways, through the annual appropriations process, new programs may emerge. So if you check the DOT website periodically, you may find news of new grant programs after new legislation is passed. So stay tuned.
Great, Danielle. And just to reiterate, there are just tons of grant opportunities from both the headquarters and the states, so initiate those conversations. There's an opportunity for you whether or not you want to do streets or ports or bike paths, or it's out there.
Yep.
But there's just not enough money out there to tackle every transportation infrastructure need in the country. And there are financing opportunities as well, in loan programs and guarantees. There's other help that the DOT can help provide. So can you talk a little bit about what the financing options are that cities and communities might be able to take advantage of?
Yes, happy to. So, and as Andy said, I'm working in the new Build America Bureau, which was just stood up in July of this year. However, some of the programs that the Build America Bureau oversees have been programs, loan programs, credit programs within the department for many years. So I'll talk just about a few of the programs today that I think may be of interest to the folks on the webinar. One is TIFIA, so we'll advance to the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act. So we named the program after the actual legislation. So you'll often hear project sponsors refer to TIFIA. It's a great program that provides loans, loan guarantees, and lines of credit to transportation projects. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's to transportation agencies. So there's a wide range of project sponsors are eligible. TIFIA loans are often provided to private investment companies as well as to states and local agencies. Following the FAST Act, which was passed in December of 2015, TIFIA has been expanded, and it now has the capacity to provide up to $20 billion in credit assistance. So it has a lot of advantages to it. It provides low-cost, low-interest loans at the Treasury rate and flexible repayment terms. And the federal government can serve as a flexible patient investor. So what that means is essentially there are, in some cases, the repayments do not need to start until 5 years after substantial completion of a project. So there are a lot of benefits to TIFIA. The other major program is RIF, but before I talk about RIF, I'll talk about private activity bonds just briefly to touch on. Private activity bonds are often used. They're tax-exempt bonds for projects with private investment. They can sometimes provide gap financing and an early source of financing, and often are combined with TIFIA financing to help project sponsors with early activities for a project. It could include site preparation activities. PABs serve to lower the cost of capital to the private sector and therefore encourage their investment, and they're often used within a public-private partnership structure to provide lower cost of capital to the private sector. So it's another interesting source of funding from the department and is authorized at about $15 billion, and we set aside allocations for eligible projects. So that's another area where the department isn't restricted to providing PABs financing just to transportation projects, so it can support a wide variety of projects that have linkages to transportation within communities, but not the sponsor doesn't necessarily have to be a transportation agency. I'll next talk briefly about RIF, which is the Railroad Rehabilitation and Improvement Financing Program. RIF has provided federal loan support to finance railroad and intermodal equipment and infrastructure throughout the country. Projects must provide a public benefit, so it's important for project sponsors to be able to meet some of the parameters of the program. Project must have safety, economic development, or environmental benefits to a community. The program is authorized up to $35 billion. With $7 billion that is reserved for short line railroads other than the Class 1 railroads. So it's a great program for railroad rehabilitation. May or may not be a great fit for some of your projects, but a lot of communities have tapped RIF loans. They are direct loans that can fund up to 100% of eligible project costs. I should note that TIFIA generally funds a third of project costs. So for a project that has a rail component and a rail partner, tapping RIF can provide an additional source of credit. So it can be valuable to some sponsors to combine programs as well. It also has very low interest rates and very flexible repayment terms. The next slide just goes through some of the priorities that I mentioned. The RIF application process ensures that from a project eligibility standpoint that projects promote economic development, improve railroad stations and passenger facilities, or increase transit-oriented development, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And also, it's important that they enhance service and capacity in the national rail system. So that those are some of the key priorities for the RIF program. Next, I'll talk about transit-oriented development, which was something that the FAST Act in December made TOD projects eligible under both RIF and TIFIA. In order to promote commercial and residential development near transit hubs, increase ridership, and promote sustainable communities. So this has been a great new capacity of TIFIA and RIF. The challenge for the department has been to develop TOD guidance for both programs, so we are in the process of developing that guidance now, which should be published in within the next couple of months. So we'll keep an eye out for, if you're interested in transit-oriented development projects, if you have those in your community that may benefit from DOT credit programs, we should have forthcoming guidance soon. The important thing is that the project must be physically or functionally related to a transportation facility. So while the project itself may not have transportation elements to it, there are restrictions on how close to transit facilities the project is. And for under RIF, the project needs to be in close proximity to a passenger rail station or a multimodal station that includes rail service. So that's important. And I'll conclude just with some additional resources just for folks who are on the webinar to reach within the department. There are a lot of federal requirements that are stipulated when a project sponsor secures DOT financing assistance. So it's important to be aware of the National Environmental Policy Act review requirements for projects that receive DOT credit, as well as other federal requirements such as Buy America. So you can find more information on some of the federal requirements associated with the loan programs on the DOT website. Thank you.
And just a last question for you. Just a lot of folks will want to take that next step, and how should they do that? What's the follow-up they should do based upon the information that you provided?
Well, the nice thing is, and I'll start with the short answer to Andy's question is call the Build America Bureau. So the idea of the Bureau was to be a one-stop shop for DOT funding and financing assistance for projects, and to be an entry point for project sponsors who may not know how to navigate the various loan programs and funding programs within the department. In 2015, Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox released a 30-year framework called Beyond Traffic, and this paper really looked at the latest data and trends and choices facing the transportation system over the next 30 years. And found really, and many of you know this from the discussions around infrastructure of late, that if we fail to invest in transportation infrastructure, despite projections for population growth and peak congestion and increased freight and trade flows, the future will mean stranded commuters, congested ports, and really failing bridges, tunnels, and roadways. So lots of challenges, I think, for the U.S. in terms of the infrastructure backlog. And the Build America Bureau was really set up to start to really focus on infrastructure investment and help make the process for securing funding and financing less rigorous for project sponsors. The fact is that funding and financing, funding infrastructure has become more difficult than actually building it. And I think Andy started with this, that really there aren't enough grant resources available to project sponsors to advance projects. So really combining the Build America Bureau has really been set up to help communities figure out alternative financing mechanisms and providing streamlined access to both credit and to navigating through the complex regulations, credit structures, and coordination within the federal government that's often required when you seek public financing. On the private side, throughout the U.S. have a lot of interest from private investors who are ready to jump in and invest in infrastructure projects, but they often have trouble identifying suitable projects and don't know how to facilitate through the public-private partnership process. So the Bureau is really strategically set up to help with that process. I'll give you just a short history on the Build America Bureau. It will hopefully get additional traction in the coming year as it stood up. We basically grew out of a White House initiative called the Build America Investment Initiative, which started in the summer of 2014. Previously within the department, our credit programs were really distributed throughout the department within FHWA and Federal Railroad Administration and in the Office of the Secretary. The idea of establishing a Build America Investment Center within Transportation Investment Center within DOT came about in the summer of 2015. And then with the passage of the FAST Act in December 2015, which called for the establishment of a new National Surface Transportation Innovative Finance Bureau. The Bureau was formed in July of 2016, as Andy mentioned. So we are relatively new. The FAST Act enabled basically was one of the first long-term transportation bills in more than 10 years' time. So it authorized $305 billion for fiscal 16 for all the modes. And with the establishment of the Bureau, it's making the process for credit assistance much more rational for project sponsors. I won't go into great detail, but the Bureau's mission is to expand, innovate, and deliver, and really expand the use of federal transportation credit programs. We have the capacity to loan up to $50 billion in loans. That capacity has not been tapped historically, has not been tapped for a variety of reasons, and so the idea is to get more loans out the door and build more good projects faster, as my director often will say. The second leg of the mission is to innovate and really to look at innovative ways to advance projects, good projects, and we're working closely with, in partnership with AASHTO, the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, who've established a Build America Institute to help educate and inform project sponsors. So AASHTO's institute often will hold webinars in support of the Build America Bureau's efforts. And then finally, it's to deliver. So the mission of the Bureau is really to get more loans out the door and facilitate project delivery. So we're already seeing in the short time the Bureau's been in existence advancement of several large projects. You can learn more at the Build America website. I will just highlight that there's a couple of additional slides here that you'll have access to that outline the programs of the Bureau. We are really looking forward to working with and have already been working with communities all over the country. So if you have further interest in our programs, there's resources here for you, a lot of best practices, papers, and webinars available online for you to get more information. Thank you.
And we've got the contact information up there if you've got some follow-up questions that you want to tackle after today's webinar. So thank you, Danielle. And again, just if you've got questions, and I've seen some folks already typing their questions in, if you want to dive deeper into any of the transportation resources that have been mentioned, go ahead and type those in at any point. We're going to shift gears now and talk about water infrastructure. I've got Sonia Brubaker from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Water Infrastructure and Resilience Finance Center. She's the program manager there. She works on identifying leading-edge water infrastructure funding and financing for communities in need. The Water Finance Center helps communities to make informed decisions for drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater infrastructure. Sonia's background, she received a Master's of Environmental Management with an emphasis in leadership from Duke University and a Bachelor of Science in Environmental Policy and Planning from Virginia Tech. And Sonia, just to put everyone on the same page, just I wanted to give you an opportunity. What is the Water Finance Center?
Thanks, Andy. So EPA's Water Finance Center was created in January 2015 as an information and technical assistance center to really to help communities make informed decisions when they are thinking of funding and financing their drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater infrastructure. And there's a recognition that drinking water and wastewater utilities are really anchor institutions within a community. You know, water infrastructure is needed for economic development and residential household use that really sustain local economies. And so our center helps communities identify funding sources and financing approaches to update their infrastructure.
There are a number of funding sources, both nationally and at the state level as well, that EPA passes through for water and water infrastructure projects. Can you talk some about where people would uncover some of these resources?
Yes, absolutely. So our center does not give out grants or loans, but we work with our program offices that do. And then we provide that information directly to communities on the types of funding that's available. So EPA has been providing funding for water infrastructure for a while, and we have a few different programs. We have some two different loan programs. One is a little bit older than the other one. And then we have a couple of grant programs that are really narrowly focused on drinking water and wastewater infrastructure and the Alaska Native villages along the U.S.-Mexico border, as well as the Tribal Assistance Program. And then we very recently have started our WIPIA program, which is similar to the TIFIA program that we just heard about. But there will be more to come on that because that just started. But I really want to focus on the two loan programs because they have the greatest reach across the country. So we have the Clean Water State Revolving Loan Program that was started in 1987, and then we have the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Program that was started in 1997. And these are our FY15 numbers. But the cumulative federal funds awarded for drinking water are about $19 billion, and for clean water are about $42 billion. And these work by Congress providing EPA with a capitalization grant which then EPA provides to the states. And the states are really able to leverage this money and make it grow by through the municipal bond market, co-funding with other agencies such as USDA and HUD, as well as state matches. So the numbers is really bigger than what EPA provides on an annual basis. But really with these loans, they are provided at or below market interest rates. And they also have long repayment terms, which are very helpful. So eligible projects under the state revolving funds, on the drinking water side, it typically funds projects that go from source to treatment and also transmission and distribution for the pipes, as well as creating new water systems and also combining existing water systems. And the Clean Water SRF is used to construct publicly owned treatment works and can also fund non-point source projects as well as national estuary program projects. The Clean Water SRF can also fund stormwater, including green infrastructure. And even though these are two separate loan programs, they can fund some of the same things, including technical assistance for project planning and design, as well as different projects related to resilience and sustainability, such as water security measures, energy efficiency, and also water reuse and water recycling. Another thing that both of the SRFs can fund are related to the Green Project Reserve, which is this allocates a specific portion of these capitalization grants to be used for projects such as green infrastructure, energy efficiency, and water efficiency.
And just along the same lines with the Department of Transportation, the federal dollars just will never be enough to satisfy the water infrastructure demands across the country. Can you talk to folks about water financing opportunities that the Water Finance Center helps connect communities with?
Yeah, absolutely. So we provide communities information on the funding that's available that EPA provides and that states provide, and also that other federal agencies provide for water infrastructure. But we also provide information on how utilities and municipalities are able to implement financing mechanisms through water and wastewater utilities typically charge user rates. But there are some other financing mechanisms that we have looked into, such as public-private and also public-public partnerships. So we have worked with the University of North Carolina Environmental Finance Center to look at some public-private partnerships and public-public partnerships that have been done in the water sector. There have been a lot of P3 projects that have been done in other sectors, such as transportation, but there are some that have been done in the water side. So we wanted to take a look at those and look at the benefits of the project, as well as just the processes involved in closing a transaction and the performance of the agreement over time. So we have about a little over a half dozen of these profiles that will that are being developed. They're almost finalized, and they're looking at projects that have already closed. So another financing mechanism that we have looked at are how utilities are creating customer assistance programs. And these programs are voluntary programs that they've created for customers that have difficulty paying their water and sewer bills. Typically, within a municipality, there are usually some subset of households that really have trouble paying. And so these programs are really focused on those who are on fixed incomes or lower incomes, as well as households that may just be facing a temporary crisis, such as a job loss, an illness, or a divorce. So what we did is we looked at about 800 utilities across the country, medium-sized to large-sized, to see if they have developed a program. And so what we found is that there are different types of programs that have been developed. And on the next slide, we see that there are bill discounts that have been developed, flexible terms. Some utilities have developed lifeline rates, and others have focused their programs more specifically on either temporary assistance or water efficiency measures that help with more kind of long-term. So what we did is we developed some profiles of the different types, where we give examples of municipalities that have created these sorts of programs, and then we also provide information on the opportunities and as well as some challenges and considerations if other utilities would like to implement one of these programs. And this is available on our website, which we will have available at the end of this presentation.
And as well, I know that you work with a number of partners and just a number of tools out there. What is the Water Finance Center doing to increase funding access and readiness in communities across the country?
So we focus a lot on helping utilities, again, understand what funding sources are available, as well as the financing mechanisms that they have. But they really have to be at a place where they're able to be able to apply for funding or be able to implement these programs. So we do a lot of work on helping communities with financial planning as well as pre-development activities that get them to that point that they can then apply for that loan or implement that program. So one of the big resources that we have at our center are our regional environmental finance centers. And I mentioned the one in UNC, which is located in our EP Region 4, that helped on one of our projects. But we have 10 across the country. Well, actually, we have 9. We have, in 2016, we put out a solicitation and awarded 9 core grants. But Region 8, we put out a new solicitation because we didn't receive any entries from them within that region. But we just closed an RFP, and so we will have a Region 8 center very soon. So I am going to say that we have 10 because we have historically had 10. But these have been around since our earliest EFC was from 1992. So while our center is just a couple of years old, the Regional Environmental Finance Centers have been around doing a lot of great work for a long time. So we work very closely with them to provide technical assistance to communities. Another thing that we have been doing as the Water Finance Center, but also working with these regional EFCs, are to hold regional water finance forums across the country. So these are a series of forums that we're holding where we're really looking to bring together communities with water infrastructure finding needs and really an interactive peer-to-peer networking format. We have communities come in and speak about how they have successfully funded and financed resilient water infrastructure projects so that you know they can hear from peers on how they did it. And we really want this to have the opportunity where communities can meet their key regional funding and technical assistance contacts. So we have held a few forums already. So we have held one in Region 6, Region 2, Region 10, or Region 3, and Region 1, and then we're going to have one in Region 9 coming up in April. So another project that we work with our ESCs on is our Water Care Communities project. And this is a project where we're really focusing on the pre-development technical assistance for really mid-sized communities across the country. So we are working with 10 communities, one in each of our EPA regions, on helping with planning for their drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater infrastructure needs. And so they are receiving financial and technical guidance to really support their community investment in their water infrastructure. In each of these communities, they are mid-sized with populations under 100,000. Some have either acute or chronic problems that have an immediate public health need. Nearly all have some degree of MHI consideration. And they all were selected because they have a readiness to proceed and to work toward improving their water infrastructure. So we are working with them. We are in the middle of our kind of two-year cycle. And so at the end, we will have project profiles that detail, what exactly the water care solutions to their problems were that can be shared nationally. And we'll also have some case studies on specific issues that that many can benefit from, such as how to implement rate structures, how to communicate to the public infrastructure needs. And lastly, within our Water Finance Center, we also have a FACA, a Federal Advisory Committee, that focuses specifically on environmental finances. So they have been in operation since the early 90s as well. There's about 30 board members where we meet a couple of times a year. Our next meeting is here in Washington, D.C., and likely will be in the February timeframe. And what's interesting about this board is that it doesn't just focus on water. While there is, while with Under the Water Finance Center, they have been giving us a number of recommendations that pertain to water, but they can actually have focal areas all across the agency. So we are working in a number of areas with different offices on environmental finance topics.
And Sonia, I know that you've got some tools in development, and I wanted you to tee that up for folks to pay attention in 2017 to how they might tap into water infrastructure, grants, loans, and financing.
Yeah, absolutely. So how we're pulling it all together is we're developing a water finance clearinghouse that's really going to be a resource for states and communities to be able to identify those funding sources and to get information on the financing approaches as well as the access and readiness sort of technical assistance. So we're going to have this all web-based. We're developing a very snazzy-looking website that we're really excited about. And it's really going to have two databases and kind of one platform. Again, it's going to focus on the resources and the funds. And so this is really, really, really small text, but we just want to give an indication of all the things that are going to be in our clearinghouse. So on the resource side for financing approaches, say if you want to look at, you know, how to implement drinking water or wastewater rates, or how to implement a stormwater fee to generate a stormwater utility, or if you're interested in green bonds or public-private partnerships, there will be some search functions for that. We will also have special topic areas such as financing drought resiliency or disaster recovery financing. And the resource types that we're going to have, they are going to be a national, state, local, and they will be reports, webinars, case studies, guides, outreach presentations. And then on our second kind of database in one, looking really at the fund side, we're going to have information on all the federal funds that are available for water infrastructure, including the annual funding levels and how to apply. So it will be a wealth of information, as well as we really want to drill down to the state level of the state funding that's available. So we recognize this is a lot. We are doing all of our research now, and we're really excited to make these annual updates and to keep it great. And so we're hoping that it's available. Where we're aiming for a late spring / early summer of 2017. So we will provide, we will have a webinar and provide some outreach when it's out.
Thank you much. And I've got just a couple of slides here where you can send some contact information, where you can send some information. Here's the contact information where you can send it, and the website address or the Water Finance Center. So we're going to transition again. So if you've got water infrastructure questions, go ahead and type those in. We'll get to those in just a couple of minutes during the Q&A period. We're going to transition now to the Army Corps of Engineers and the resources they can provide along your shoreline. And as a surrogate for the Army Corps, I've got somebody who's worked with the Corps programs. Matt Ward is the CEO of Sustainable Strategies DC, which helps cities chase resources for their community revitalization needs. As it relates to today, he is experienced working with the Army Corps to secure funding for local infrastructure. He received his Bachelor of Arts from American University and a Juris Doctorate from the University of Virginia. So, Matt, as you're thinking about the Army Corps and what their particular role is as it relates to cities, how can they help somebody with a contaminated site on a river, lake, harbor, or waterfront?
Well, thanks, Andy, and hi, everybody out there. This is Matt Ward, and the Army Corps of Engineers has been playing a role in the nation's waterways since George Washington created the Army Corps of Engineers and started working on America's waterways. And when we talk about American development, a lot of America's growth and development has happened on waterways, and of course, that can mean that those are the spots where brownfields are because of historical industrial development and other activities that may have contaminated the waterfront. So it's difficult to do a riverfront, harborfront, lakefront project in many communities without encountering contamination. And you're going to likely need to work with the Corps under a regulatory perspective or want to work with the Corps to be able to obtain expertise, assistance, and resources to do that. So when you look at what the Corps of Engineers does, this is a organization that provides design, engineering, and construction management services all across the country working on the nation's water bodies. So there are a number of what the Corps of Engineers will tell you are missions that they engage in, and they really come down to water resources, environmental, and infrastructure missions. At least those are the ones that are relevant to potential leveraging brownfields revitalization resources. So when you talk about water resources, if you're looking at flood control, if you're dealing with dredging of a harbor or a river, you will almost certainly be dealing with the Corps, and you may likely be dealing with contamination issues in brownfields. When you talk about navigation, one-sixth of America's freight comes through Corps projects and Corps-maintained waterways, ports and harbors, 900 ports and harbors across the country, including 300 major commercial ports and harbors, and 600 recreational or smaller ports and harbors, all of which may have revitalization brownfield projects in them or around them in many communities. And then when you talk about recreation, the Corps provides more recreational land and facilities than any other organization in the United States of America. Look at that figure, more than 2,400 separate recreation areas across the country, lakefronts, waterfronts, riverfronts, parks, and things like that, also part of the brownfields equation. If you shift to the environmental mission that the Corps has, established by Congress and pursued by the Corps for many years, there's water ecosystem recreation, there's the cleanup of formerly used defense sites and munition sites, there are mine-scarred lands and Superfund sites. Superfund sites are not brownfields, but they're certainly part of the community revitalization and the EPA equation. The Corps of Engineers has been involved in all of these things for quite a long time and have quite a bit of expertise and experience there. If you look at the picture there, you'll see Glen Cove, New York on the Long Island Sound, and that Glen Cove Creek extends right into the downtown of the city, and all along the north side of that creek for decades and decades was a munitions plant operating for the Department of Defense that used tungsten, which is radioactive. And, you know, back in the day before we knew better, all the tungsten got thrown in the creek, the scrap tungsten, and became a major brownfield site that is now undergoing a $1 billion tourism, mixed-use development, and recreational revitalization. The Corps of Engineers has been heavily involved in that project. One last thing on this slide is that the Corps does serve a regulatory role. That could be a whole another topic for a webcast that we won't focus on here, but when you're dredging and filling, when you're impacting wetlands, you're likely to be dealing with the Corps from a regulatory Section 404 or other permitting perspective that often is involved in a brownfield project. So if you move to the next slide, so, you know, what does the Corps have to do with brownfields contamination itself? Again, they design, engineer, and construct in what they call in the Corps of Engineers parlance HTRW, hazardous, toxic, and radioactive waste. And if you look at that middle bullet, you'll see the kinds of services that some Corps district offices can provide when you're dealing with contaminated waterfronts. And that list pretty much reads like a brownfield assessment, planning, and cleanup list. And that is almost a direct quote from the Louisville, Kentucky Corps District. They have a HTRW design team that will help you with technical assistance, planning, and engineering of all those things. I will take this opportunity, though, to say that that you may call up a Corps of Engineers district office and say, I have a waterfront brownfield that I'd like to work on, and you just may get the answer, we don't do brownfields. We're not involved in brownfields. And so it's probably better to say, we have some HTRW in a waterfront situation, and we'd like to talk with your designers and engineers about the types of services you can provide to help us do water resource projects that happen to have environmental issues associated with them. And so that's just a tip that speak their language, and they'll do brownfields with you, whether you call them a brownfield or not. That last bullet is a very important, which is that if you have contamination in the waterway, in the sediments, in the waterway itself, you can structure a project with Corps resources where the remediation, cleanup, addressing those contamination issues in the waterway can be paid for as a project cost if you're able to secure Corps funding for engineering or construction. But if it's landside contamination, while the Corps may be involved in the design and engineering of dealing with landside contamination to make sure that it does not impact the water resource, generally it's going to be the non-federal sponsors. It's going to be your communities or the states or the port authorities' responsibility to pay for the cleanup of HDRW that's on the land, even if there's a very clear land-water interface. So when it comes to contamination, that's how the Corps considers its role in those waterfront brownfields. So how's it work? Let's move to the next slide.
You mentioned that you need to talk their language, and we'll skim the surface here just because there are a number of different authorities that the Corps has, and these are all congressionally mandated and have been for years. As folks are talking their language, what should they be talking about?
Okay, great. Now, often when you talk with a federal or state agency, you talk about programs. In the Corps parlance, you're talking about authorities, which means the authority that Congress has given them to do projects. And there are three ways that you can work with the Corps of Engineers generally. One way is to go in and with your congressional delegation get a project authorization for your project itself. The U.S. Senate and the U.S. House just passed on Friday a new Corps authorization bill, the Water Resources Development Act, that contained 35 projects across America. 35 is not a lot, and the reason is that those statutorily authorized projects are big, you know, $100 million, billion-dollar projects that take really years and lots of political firepower to get done. We're not going to talk about those. And when you're doing a brownfield along your riverfront, that's you may be going for a major authorized project, but we're going to talk about two other methods. One is fairly new, the Water Resources Development Act, which is the law that governs the Corps, not the one passed last week, but the one passed 2 years ago in 2014, included a brand new approach that is continued in the current Corps law, which is called the Section 7001 process. And this allows a city or county or other non-federal party to approach the Corps and say, we have a whole, you know, harborside revitalization project that used to be our old industrial area, and now we'd like to make it, you know, not flood, and we'd like to restore the shoreline and the ecosystem and put a bike trail and a new mixed-use development on it. That is, we've got a brownfield or HTRW situation. You can propose through Section 7001 a project. It starts with writing a letter to your core district office. And a couple slides I'm going to tell you about how to work with your core district office, but you need to write a letter and partner with your core district office to propose a project. Your project should try to confine itself within the existing core authorities. If you say, we want to build a baseball stadium with a, you know, an airport runway in back, the Corps is going to say, that's not a core mission, that's not a core authority. So you're really going to want to be talking about water resource projects. It will get ranked. It'll go up through a big hierarchical process all the way up to the head of the Corps of Engineers and the White House. Congress will be substantially involved, and if you succeed in that Section 7001 process, you will get a study, you'll start engineering, and you may just get a big project done over time. The last way, and probably the most common way of working with the Corps on brownfields, is under their continuing authorities programs, or the CAP programs. This is where Congress does not have to authorize a specific project in Toledo or Kalamazoo. It's where there's a set of programs that allow you to move forward just with the Corps without going through Congress. So if we move to the next, we're going to move back a slide. I'm not going to go through all these core authorities. You can look at this slide. You can look at the slides when you download them. There are about a dozen continuing authorities there. They generally have a 50-50 cost share or sometimes a 65-35 cost share for things that are beneficial reuse of dredged materials, ecosystem restoration, environmental improvements. That is waterfront brownfield aspects. You look there at Portland, that's the South Portland Waterfront Gateway. It's a major brownfield redevelopment done with the Corps of Engineers in Portland, Oregon. These usually go up to $10 million federal. That's pretty unusual. They're more like $3, $5, $7 million programs. So those are the continuing authorities and how you can work with the Corps.
And just real quick, Matt, what's the next step that people have to do if they want to work with the Corps?
All right. Most importantly, without a doubt, is work with your Corps district office. There are 41 district offices across the country organized under 8 divisions. There's a URL there that shows you how you can find your district office. These are where the planners, program managers, engineers will be that are going to work with you on a continuing authority or a Section 7001 project. If you don't have your district on board, you're not going to work with the Corps. Think about your matching sources early on. If you want to do a Section 7001 proposal, work with your district office and write a letter. And while the Corps can do things under continuing authorities, without congressional authorization, we will say for sure that Congress and congressional members and senators work very closely in this process. Without going into it, there may even restore the congressional earmark process later this year for Corps projects. You need to work with your members of Congress to navigate through this process.
Thanks, Matt. So we're going to tie it up now with a Toledo case study. And I'm going to introduce three folks real quick. Mark Gerdman manages the Toledo Brownfield Program, and he's a trained environmental professional with experience in brownfields assessment and remediation activities. Scott Sibley is Toledo's Administrator of Utilities Engineering, where he's responsible for implementing over $20 million of water, stormwater, and sanitary sewer projects annually. And David Dicer is an administrator for Toledo's Division of Engineering Services in roadway and open space planning. And in that role, he's involved in roadway and bikeway project planning and development. So Toledo has been doing excellent brownfields work over the years, and we're going to hear how they are leveraging those EPA brownfield resources with other federal and state and other funding as well. So Mark, Scott, David, take it away.
All right. Thanks, Andy. You know, we'd like to thank USEPA and Sustainable Strategies for inviting us to this webinar and participating in this. Just basically kind of an overview of our brownfield program. Is, you know, we help facilitate property transactions. We help complete environmental assessments and remediation to assist in redevelopment of properties within Toledo. We've had great success with USEPA, and we've been awarded 21 USEPA grants and many other $8 million in supplementals with in other various federal, state, and local programs.
Hey, Mark, I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah. Is there any way I can get you closer to the speakerphone? We've got a couple of comments. You're coming in a little bit low.
Okay, sure. Can you hear me better now?
Anything you can do to get a little bit closer?
All right, how about now?
That sounds a little bit better. Thank you, Mark.
Okay. So, you know, the first slide just talks about our program and, you know, how much we work with, you know, the USEPA. We've had great success. And so there's, you know, that slide here. The next slide basically just shows our most recent awards from USEPA grants. And in particular, I would like to talk about the area-wide planning grant that we were awarded in 2013. A lot of the transportation and other projects that we're going to discuss are kind of all incorporated into this, and as well as that project area, which Dave will touch on in a little bit. But as you can see, we use quite a bit of assessment dollars and go after cleanup grants when necessary for redevelopment of projects in Toledo. So this slide actually should come last, but I just wanted to highlight some of the projects that the City of Toledo has as far as the Department of Transportation goes and other state programs. But I'm going to advance one slide so Dave can kind of talk about the kind of the project area for what we're discussing.
Good afternoon. Dave Dysart here. talking about brownfield sites, what we thought as an example is the Jeep industrial site. We won World War II for you. You can congratulate us after the phone call. Produced all the Jeeps that were used in World War II here on this site. On the slide, you can see the industrial complex sort of just to the below the red lines of the interstate. The red lines are I-75, and in this area, two things were happening. That Jeep plant was abandoned, and Mark and his folks worked, and we got the brownfield site funds in there. We cleaned up that site, and our state DOT said we need to rebuild this stretch of I-75, and oh, by the way, we're going to change the access in this area a great deal, eliminate a couple of interchanges, and change how you access the interstate highway. You want to go ahead, Mark? This is details you don't need to know. Just there were sections of street that were removed and taken out. Half interchange that had been there since the dawn of the interstate era were being taken out, and access was being changed. Go ahead. So what we did is the other thing, as I said, was the change of the Jeep site into the Overland Industrial Park. This is an overview, shows the site, talking about converting this back to industrial use, but cleaning up the site, getting it all ready, building new infrastructure, new streets, and then having to change the access to the freeway. So that was the genesis of us all working together. We've had a great partnership from the environmental side, the engineering side, to try to coordinate in this area, and then as Mark said, we were successful in getting the area-wide planning program to try to pull the pieces together. How do we revitalize this important part of our city? You want to change? Next one. This is a study area from our transportation study where we looked at the access concerns and how the different interchanges would be reconnected and what we could come up with to solve the problems. Next slide, please. And then in working through the transportation process, if you're not familiar with it, it's very important to lay out your purpose and need. What is it you're trying to do? So here was just you were looking at the connectivity to the freeway and the different development sites, improved traffic operations, and then there were other added benefits. We're in a corridor of the Ottawa River, which was one of those brownfield sites in a river that had been highly polluted industrially. What can we do to clean this up, actually turn that around and make a recreation resource, a benefit out of that, and that tied us into the bikeway planning, things like that. Also, our city is looking at roundabouts. We're probably behind the curve of many of you. A lot of other places are a little further along, but we're looking at that as an efficient control mechanism, intersection design, something by policy we've been pushing here in our region. Mark, you want to go ahead? And then So we look, as I said, at other opportunities, the Green Corridor. We're looking at landscaping and just rebranding and redeveloping this section of our city. And I think the next slide. So this is what we came up with after a lot of analysis and study, five roundabouts, the whole corridor being redeveloped. In the middle of the area there, we took out an auto junkyard, cleaned up all that, and we tied into the industrial site. In addition, if you go to the next one, we looked at, in this area, this first slide, you can't see it. It's not meant to be there for detail. Just to give you the overview, we do have a bike plan. Our bike plan in the city involves 13 distinct corridors, trails that we put together. You want to go to the next one. In this area, we have one called the Overland Trail to acknowledge the historical significance in this area. And it goes right through this brownfield area. You can kind of see at the top of the slide it going through that area that's vacant on the aerial photo there. That's the old Jeep plant site where we're working with the Corps of Engineers. They're doing some stormwater work. Mark and the guys locally have been able to clean up that site, and so we'll have a bike path through here, through a nice cleaned up area along this river in a new industrial area, kind of pulling all the pieces together. So that's specifically this Overland Trail work. Now, if we can go back to that first slide again, Mark, because, you know, folks, we were told folks are going to be interested in, well, how in the devil do you pay for all this stuff? And that really is a problem. And you've got to put together all the pieces anywhere you can, any place you can beg, borrow, steal some money, and pull the pieces together. In our case, with the roundabouts, that brought in the possibility of using the USDOT, I think they called it the allocate apportioned funds, through our MPO group. In our case, it's called the Toledo Metropolitan Area Council of Governments. We were able to get congestion mitigation air quality funding, and you can see there over $2 million there. On the roadway side, there's another program that similarly is administered through your MPO group, so get to know them. They're an important piece in finding funding in transportation. A surface transportation block grant program, we were able to get several $1 million there to assist with the project, and that pulls all the pieces together. In our state, I imagine most all your states, there is some kind of state funding besides, and ours is called the Ohio Public Works Commission funds. That's a separate bond program that was put together to provide funding to local governments to help with things like that. On the bike path side, we weren't successful in getting a grant here through this program, but I mention it because it's a program you definitely want to follow up on. Transportation Alternatives Program, likewise the others. This is administered, it's USDOT money through the state to the MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization. So on the transportation side, that is a really critical component, working with that group, understanding their funding competition and resources. These are not programs, at least in our area, that you turn around and apply 1 year, get the money the next year. These are programmed out 4 and 5 and 6 years into the future. So you have to come together with a plan, get your vision, know where you're going, and then pursue the funding as best you can, the different programs and how the pieces fit together. So from a transportation side, this is how we were able to be part of this overall process in the area-wide planning area to redevelop that whole corridor and put those things in. So I think at this point I turn over to Scott Sibley to talk about some of the infrastructure programs in stormwater and water.
Thanks, Dave. I wanted to focus on the city's combined sewer overflow efforts. The city has been involved or basically settled a lawsuit with US EPA and the Department of Justice in 2001, which culminated in a consent decree that we are following to control our combined sewer overflows. We call that our Toledo Waterways Initiative, and it involves, it's a 20-year program, about $520 million, and it involves 45 projects. So with a project of that size or a program of that size, we're looking for as much grant and loan funding as we can get. It turns out that a number of these 45 projects are located coincidentally on brownfield sites. Probably because their brownfield sites tend to be unused open space. They have proximity to waterways, which is also where our combined sewer overflows are occurring, and a lot of them are publicly owned. So while it wasn't our intent to go to locate these facilities on brownfield sites, it turns out that a good number of them are. And the city has been fortunate enough in leveraging a large amount of federal and state grant and loan funding for this program. And we go after grants, as this slide shows. We go after grants to the maximum extent, but they tend to be a lot more limited or a lot scarcer than loan funds. So we've gone after as many grants as we can. From the Corps of Engineers, we've gotten a few dollars. There's an old program, I don't think it's still around, called State and Tribal Assistance, or STAG grants. The state of Ohio has a loan program called Ohio Water Development Authority, but the biggest portion of our remaining financing is coming from the Water Pollution Control Loan Fund, which is a state revolving fund that is money funneled from the US EPA. The unfortunate thing about the loan dollars, of course, is you have to pay them back. The next slide shows just one of our projects as an example. It's our International Park Storage Basin project, which just got underway in construction in September. That's a $26 million project. It includes a 6.9 million gallon storage basin and connecting pipelines. And it's located in a city park. It's a former rail and shipping yard dating back to the 19th century. And that project will be completed in October. It's funded with both with mostly water pollution control loan fund dollars and some Ohio Public Works Commission dollars.
Okay. Thanks, Scott. When Dave was talking in his presentation about get to know your partners throughout the area-wide planning process, since we were fortunate to get that grant, we really had to look, around to see what kind of community partners and things, basically what kind of entities had ways to help us out with this project. Our project with area-wide plan encompassed 660 acres. And we focused on three reuse areas for former brownfields. So as you can see, this was one of our kind of our topic areas over here at the former Jeep site. And when we came in to this, as far as trying to get reuse of brownfield money, we started to see what kind of partners, federal partners, are out there. We hosted a partners workshop towards the end of the grant cycle and brought in DOT, HUD, Department of Agriculture, and a couple other federal agencies to kind of figure out here's what, some key initiative and action items that we need to, in order to get these brownfields revitalized. And they were able to kind of pick their programs and look at basically what they could help out the city with as far as what we needed for that. So when we look into, one of the portions of the plan was for need for more green infrastructure and kind of to green up the area especially for the neighborhoods. This area that you see here all lies by the Ottawa River here. It lies in a 100-year floodplain, and we were working with the Army Corps of Engineers. They were funded through a Great Lakes Restoration Initiative grant. And they looked at a feasibility study to construct a wetland in this area. I mean, the Port Authority kind of owns this property, but realistically, you can't build on this because it's in a 100-year floodplain. So we're looking for ideas to increase fish habitat, restore floodplain wetlands, and riparian habitat. So this area, the Army Corps was doing a couple-year feasibility study on this 18-acre parking lot, and currently they're still working on developing alternatives and ideas to basically recreate this as a good green infrastructure project. We also have great partners. The University of Toledo was awarded another GLRI grant, and their main purpose was to create a stormwater amphitheater, which basically, their goal was to remediate and restore floodplain as well, but using phytoremediation was their emphasis. So this was constructed in 2013. I have to go back one. 2013, and was basically to increase flood capacity and planting native plants here. They were hoping when the Ottawa River would flood, these native plants would help filter out some of the contaminants that passed through the Ottawa River. So that was one of the other projects we used to kind of leverage and determine what else can we do on this property. This is another funding opportunity that the city of Toledo was awarded in 2012. It was another GLRI, but this one is actually through the Department of Agriculture Forest Service. And we had a brownfield that has kind of been the central part of the city but has horrible access for transportation, so really no commercial or industrial developers want it because it's just in a bad spot. It's located in a residential neighborhood. We've done all of our assessments on it. We know that there's lead contamination in the soil. The building has been demolished, but there's literally 12 acres of impervious surface. So when it rains, we have severe stormwater runoff issues. And we wrote this grant basically saying that, these hybrid poplar trees can help uptake lead, and we wanted to create a bioswale to help mitigate this runoff. So what we did was, here's a before picture of the Cooks. This is the Cooks property in Toledo. Of a heavy rainstorm, and you can see all the stormwater runoff coming from the site and going immediately into the storm sewers. In order to reduce this, we created or we constructed a 150 by 100 foot bioswale. And in that bioswale, we used trees and shrubs and other native prairie grasses to basically slow down the water velocity and basically increase percolation to get that water in there instead of going into the storm sewer. As Scott touched on, the Tula Waterways Initiative is there to reduce combined sewer overflows in this area. I think is tied into it. So this was one way of reducing some of that stormwater getting into our sanitary sewer. And another aspect, this was one of our lead-contaminated issues, or lead-contaminated spots. So what we did was we planted some hybrid poplars there in 2015, and they're just starting to get going, and we're hoping that the lead can be uptaken through these trees to help reduce some of the soil contamination on the site. So when you're looking at your brownfield, there's a lot of looking outside the box, is what you can do for the site, and there's a lot of opportunities and programs if you can find them, So being very creative, it really has had some success for the city, and really having great partners like, with US EPA and the Region 5 office, I get email updates about funding opportunities all the time. And we have some great consulting firms in Twitter too that always try to help us, come up with ideas and, more funding options. So we're very, very fortunate on that part. If you have any questions, I would like to thank you for listening to us. Here's some of our contact information. If you want, you could direct all your questions to me, and I can kind of funnel them to Scott and David because they're extremely busy people. And, I volunteered them to do this webinar, so I'll take all the questions. So thank you.
Mark, Scott, and David, thank you so much. And you really guys did do a good job tying it all together and showing how these resources can support brownfields redevelopment. We're going to jump into Q&A now, and a number of you have already submitted questions. We're going to do Q&A for about the next 5 or so minutes. So if you do have a question, go ahead and type it in if you haven't done it yet. I'm going to turn it over to Patricia to ask the first question.
Okay, we have a question here. Is there any funding to demolish abandoned or decommissioned wastewater treatment plant structures to facilitate the redevelopment of the site?
So is there funding for demolition of wastewater treatment plants?
That is a good question. I will definitely check on that and provide an answer.
Yes, this is Patricia Obermeyer. One thing to note that your brownfield cleanup grant cannot be used to do demolition. So that's to keep in mind on that. At least your brownfield funding cannot be used for deconstruction of brownfield sites. But we will look into the answer of whether other EPA funds may be available. Another question, are there draft documents available regarding stormwater fee studies and assessments that are available now since the Water Finance Clearinghouse website won't be available until the summer of 2017?
Yes, there are some resources that are available. They are currently on our website at epa.gov/waterfinancecenter. And if you're looking for something and you cannot find it currently on our website, you can always email us at waterfinancecenter@epa.gov, and we can definitely send information to you that way as well.
Thank you. For the Toledo folks, there's a question. Is there any discussion about what to do with the poplar trees after they reach a life expectancy and given that they will contain elevated concentrations of lead?
Currently, we have not really evaluated that. The trees were just planted, last year, so we're just going to, kind of monitor them as they go. There was no funding for any type of testing of the trees or anything like that, but if there was development on the site, we would most likely have to, tear those down and probably haul them off as potentially hazardous waste. That'd be my guess.
Thank you. Sonia, I'm going to come back to you again to answer the question that someone is asking. Our community is not eligible for EPA drinking water state revolving loan fund or Clean Water Act state revolving loan fund because we do not meet the criteria for being disadvantaged. So in the case of this community, are there other financing options for them when they are below the market rate?
So the Clean Water SRF and the Drinking Water SRF can provide loans to communities that are not labeled as disadvantaged. They can provide loans that are at or below the market rate a lot of the time. Under the Clean Water SRF, there is additional subsidization that is available for communities that meet affordability criteria or communities that are implementing a material or a technology related to energy efficiency, water efficiency, stormwater mitigation, or other environmental kind of resources. So that language came through a WERDA Act that was in 2014, so that applies for wastewater. On the drinking water side, there is additional subsidization, and this essentially means a subsidy that is available through the SRF. And these criteria, the funds and the criteria typically change with annual appropriations. A lot of times they are very similar to the Clean Water SRF, but if you go to the Drinking Water SRF website, you will see exactly what is eligible.
Thank you. One attendee is asking, can EPA and DOT funds be used to co-fund the same project?
Yes, we often see projects that combine different sources of funding and would encourage, this is Danielle from the Build America Bureau, but we would encourage and work to provide technical assistance to project sponsors to see how compatible different financing programs are between federal agencies. So that is something, the kind of technical assistance that we could provide.
Yeah, and this is Sonia from EPA. EPA funds or the SRF funds can definitely be used in conjunction with other federal agency funds. There are stipulations and limits for matching and things like that. But for co-funding, yes. For DOT in particular, just off the top of my head, I could think of maybe a project that also incorporated stormwater aspects to it could potentially. That could be a potential project.
Yes, and you can always use your brownfield assessment and cleanup funds at sites where you're also using DOT, HUD funds, EDA funds, et cetera. It's quite all right to use a variety of funding mechanisms for your project, and we encourage that. We also encourage you to think through when you're using these funds. Remember, as I said, that brownfield funds can't be used for demolition. So if you need to do demolition, check and see what the criteria and restrictions and the terms and conditions for your other federal grants, on that there may be a grant from HUD or EDA where you can use those funds for demolition or other things that you need to do. So be wise in how you evaluate which funds you will use and for what kinds of activities. Another question for DOT. Is energy infrastructure and clean energy installations in particular considered physically or functionally related projects when we tie them to transportation?
That's an interesting question. I don't have, at FAA there are actually energy efficiency programs that can fund at airports, which may not be relevant for a lot of the folks on the call, that can support energy efficiency projects at airports. In the DOT landscape, I'm not sure that I know offhand of projects that have facilitated that, but that's something that I can follow up on and certainly circle back through Andy with an answer that we can record on the website at a later date.
Thank you. I think this will have to be our last question, but for the Toledo folks, a questioner is asking, what funding sources were used in the Jeep site redevelopment in Toledo. You mentioned the EPA area-wide planning grant, USDOT funds that were passed through the MPO for the surface transportation and bike path project. What about combined sanitary and stormwater overflow? Were any federal dollars used for that part of the project?
I don't think we had any sewer projects in that given area. Is that right, Scott?
No.
And yeah. So the roads that were constructed there, were they?
Yeah, there wasn't any CSOs or sewer issues as part of that project to enable using SRF funds.
My guess would be since the Port Authority had quite a bit of the Ohio Development Services Agency's Clean Ohio Fund. They had two of those awarded to them, so I don't know if they used some of those some of that funding for infrastructure. I'm not sure on that.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for hanging in there with us. I know we went a little over today, but thank you so much to our speakers, Sonia and Danielle, Matt Ward, and the folks from Toledo. Thanks for joining us, and thanks, everyone, for your participation. Please remember that all of the materials will be up on the CLUIN website, so you can get the slides, the links to the URLs, and also just remember that you have our email addresses, et cetera. We're easily accessible. Send us questions. Have them so that we can help you out. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everyone. Just a quick reminder that the next webinar is scheduled for February 28th. So happy holidays, and we look forward to talking to you in the new year. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'm going to go ahead and walk through just one final reminder before we let everybody go today. We do have, as mentioned, copies of the related resources or links and seminar slides will be posted on that page shortly. We do have information for all of the presenters off of the seminar homepage, and we would ask if each and every one of you could fill out that short online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. For those of you who would like to receive a participation certificate, if you fill out that feedback form, there will be a box you can check on the feedback form that when you submit your feedback, we will then issue a participation certificate that you can either save or print out. If multiple people participated from your location, each one of you can fill out your own version of the feedback form and get your own copy of that certificate. As noted, today's session was recorded, and you will automatically receive an email when that archived available delivery is posted for your playback on demand. Thank you again also very much for joining us today. This will be the formal conclusion of today's live broadcast.